Hey, so...
Yes, Cleon.
You know what's wild?
What's wild?
Fucking no one has talked about Ant-Man 2 yet.
Oh, yeah!
Cleon, that is because Ant-Man 2 is not about Lupin the Third, and this podcast is only about Lupin the Third. Yeah, boy. Roll the theme music.
Lupin the third.
Lupin the third. All right, we need to stop because this needs to actually be audible for people.
It probably just blew up your sound system. Mm.
Hello and welcome. We're the Lupin the Third podcast. We are Asinine Lupin.
Asinine Lupin.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Ben.
And I'm Cleon.
And we're going to be talking about our number one favorite anime. That might be a lie because Cleon does like One Piece a lot. But this is a very good anime called Lupin the Third.
Yes, and it's interesting because I feel like every time you say Lupin, it really upsets me.
Sorry, I'm white. Lupin, not Lupin. But why is there so many L's in this anime character's name?
I don't know. They shouldn't be because Japanese people say Rupan.
Rupan.
Yeah, Rupan Sanse. Right. So for the Japanese listeners, do you think we'll get any Japanese listeners?
Hi, Sodasuna.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
So they
Ohayo.
Would say...
Mushy mushy.
We're already racist. The Japanese say Rupan Sanse, which refers to Lupin the Third.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Lupin the Third because it is a manga that is written and illustrated by Monkey Punch.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, his pseudonym.
His birth name, yeah.
Yep. His then a pseudonym ended up being Kazuhiko Kato.
Okay.
And this was written in 1967. So this is a manga series that was published...
It's super old.
Really
this
old.
This is a manga that was invented before anime was a genre of watchable material.
Definitely, yeah. And it's very much something that has the same level of notoriety as, say, a Batman or even, you know, Sherlock Holmes or Doctor Who.
Like your long-running franchises, much beloved in the country of origin.
Exactly. But, you know, and one of the reasons why we're doing the podcast is because it's not really that well-known internationally.
No, it has a weird appeal in the West. Mm. And I believe, because it's so long-running, it was one of the first kind of bootleg animes that came out over time. And I think, like, in Italy, they have a high population because they got a lot of the early dubs via trading, whatever. But yeah, in the West, I haven't found many people that know of it except from recent times or from the movie that's quite popular, which we'll talk about.
Yeah. And I think it'll definitely be good to delve into the Western influence because this is one of these animes that's really popular in Japan, but doesn't actually feel very Japanese.
No.
It's very Western
in
style.
It's a love letter to that American 60s Western culture that bled over into Japan.
A lot of European influence as well.
Spy dramas, James Bond kind of feel to it, yeah. Mm.
So going back to the historical sort of aspect, so Lupin was written and illustrated by Monkey Punch. It was published in the 60s for a weekly manga magazine. And then in 1971, it was adapted as an anime.
Mm-hmm.
So Lupin, it's called Lupin the Third because it is the grandson of fictional gentleman thief Arsène Lupin.
So who's that?
So Arsène Lupin was a gentleman thief in Paris, France. And it's funny because when I first got into this, I actually remember thinking, oh, is this kind of the fictional grandson of a real life thief, but it's actually just a fictional grandson of another fictional character.
Yeah.
And much like how manga is, you know, published in magazines, these little short stories, novellas, and then eventually novels were published in magazines and periodicals in England and France, I believe. I'll need to do a little bit more research on that.
So it's like a Sherlock Holmes character, like reoccurring.
Very much.
Which was unusual for that time of fiction.
Yeah, yeah. To the point where the writer Maurice LeBlanc, who was the creator of Arsène Lupin, was actually, you know, very much inspired by Sherlock Holmes, written by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. For copyright reasons, he couldn't actually have the real Sherlock Holmes feature in his stories, so did a bit of a swap and had Arsène Lupin battle it out against Herlock Sholmes.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's not just the gender swap Sherlock Holmes. Herlock is seldom seen secret fourth brother. This sounds like a plot twist from the Sherlock BBC series.
Did you ever see Elementary?
No.
Look, it was mostly garbage. I won't say mostly garbage.
Cause my fiance loves Elementary.
Yeah, my little cousin loves it too. And it was fascinating because they actually did something that I think is very Lupin-like in the sense where, spoilers for Elementary fans, I don't even think it's going on anymore, but basically Moriarty and Irene Adler, so, you know, Sherlock Holmes' arch nemesis.
The woman.
And then the femme fatale were the same character.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So they ended up being the same character, which is actually a very Lupin
thing.
Well,
that was interesting because in that show, Watson and Lucy Liu were the same character. So
Lucy Liu wasn't a Sherlock Holmes character. No? She's an actress playing Watson.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Benjamin. So, let's talk about what Lupin the Third is about.
Yeah, okay, so he's the grandson of this master thief character from French literacy.
Yeah.
So what kind of adventures does Lupin go on?
Well, so he is a master thief, but the genre is quite flexible, I would say. Basically, the main plot line is that you would have these short stories and one-off adventures where Lupin chooses a particular thing that he wants to steal.
Mm.
He kind of has a calling card. Literally, it's a card. And yeah, the kind of adventure begins then.
Yeah. So I guess he kind of rides into that Thief of the Heart of Gold kind of thing, like a Robin Hood, or I'm trying to think of another Thief of the Heart of Gold and I'm going blank. But like, he wants to steal stuff. That's his drive. He's trying to steal whatever, like jewels, gems. It's more about the sport of stealing than about
the thrill of the possession.
He's got everything he's ever needed because he's so good at stealing.
Yeah.
But he gets caught up in adventures along the way, and those adventures can look like, you know, invading, you know, an evil spy organization. It can look like helping, you know, rescue people from a burning building for some reason, babysitting foreign delegate's granddaughter for whatever reason. However, he gets to the treasure, he goes on misadventures, and in that he's often the protagonist. He's not an evil thief. He ends up doing the greater good, but ultimately trying to get the treasure out of doing that.
Yeah, and I don't know, I think we'll probably have to do a little bit more research into the original comics because I feel like that whole Thief with the Heart of Gold may have been formed a little bit later.
Took place of a time.
But I'm not too sure about where he was at the start, but very much right in the sense that he's this guy who gets his adrenaline kicks from trying to steal things. And it's not about the treasure being like something that he's going to make money off, but it's the thrill of the chase.
It's the game. It's trying to outsmart the police, which becomes an important character later on. Yes. And his cohorts and nemesis is,
Exactly. It's also a series that kind of borders outside the edge of reality, would you say?
Yeah, it has very surreal moments that can be from character interactions, can be quite dreamlike in how they take place. But also there can be like supernatural elements to it. It's a bit like the Metal Gear Solid universe in terms of things can be very grounded, very historical, and then suddenly you've got a character with a crazy superpower.
Yeah.
Or just visual imagery can be used very esoterically. Villains can range from, you know, a samurai to the normal police, international police, to Leonardo da Vinci.
I was just going to say, to a resurrected Leonardo da Vinci.
Or a rejected Dragon Ball psychic midget.
So,
he goes up against many foes. Oh, one time he fights a guy, he just has a fishing rod. That's his. He's just really skilled at taking out people with a fishing rod. So Lupin has to be ready to outsmart anyone in his wacky misadventures.
It is interesting. I mean, what do you think about the origins of Lupin? Do you think he is this character that is self-taught in the art of thievery? Do you think, like, he comes from a guild of thieves, something, like, very similar to Assassin's Creed? Like, you know, kind of thinking about where this character comes from, because we actually don't really know much about that, but maybe it's worth talking about it now so that we have like kind of like a foundation of who we think this character is.
Lupin is, when you see him in most genres, pretty much formed already. He's had an X amount of adventures and he's gained skills and talents from that. There is a element of evolution of growth throughout the series, which we'll talk about over time, but Lupin knows how to be a master thief. He's already starting at this god tier level of thievery. So his origin is not super important. The cool thing about Lupin is he just dives into adventure and that's way on. But it does raise a question, like, he's the grandson of Lupin. What was his father like? How did he, you know, get the title Lupin the Third? Is he actually blood related to the same character from French literature? Because that's interesting. It would be like if you wrote a series about Sherlock Holmes' son. How do you make that seem more canon than it sounds?
And the fascinating thing is, this is written by, you know, a Japanese author and illustrator. Yeah. It's kind of like you say, it's kind of like saying some dude in Portugal is now writing about Sherlock Holmes's granddaughter.
But it becomes canon within the show's timeline.
And in their reality, Arsène Lupin is, of course, real life thief who existed, I guess.
And what's again interesting about the character is that the world does have to an element like a sliding time scale of, it's been running for so many years. Lupin at different points in history interacts with the culture and the themes of that year of history, but his character doesn't really age.
No.
There's a hint at time takes place and passes between seasons, but he doesn't age, but he keeps up his skills with modern technology and overcomes problems of different eras.
And it brings up what you just said, kind of brings up my ultimate comparison for Lupin, which is that he is very much like Japan's version of Batman.
A little bit.
Like, you take away the kind of, you take away the superhero out of Batman, which, I mean, is the core, but, you know.
just get the bat.
Yeah, like, you know, just take this character that's kind of timeless.
Yeah, yeah.
Adapting with the time, you know, very much of a very set aesthetic, but a set aesthetic that molds with any genre or tone. I mean, we have Batman stories that are, you know, like about serial killing. You have Batman stories that are really hard-boiled and noir-like. But then you have really campy Batman stories. We were talking earlier, we have a Ninja Batman story,
which apparently is good.
Yeah, which I personally
Lego
love.
Batman works.
Exactly.
Batman as an edgy Dark Knight works. Exactly. Batman as a comedy 60s show works. So I think what Batman does well, if you're comparing it to Lupin, is Batman maintains characters that are very consistent in the behavior. Yeah. You see this character, you understand the parameters at which the character functions, what their behaviors are going to be like, you know what to expect from the character. Mm-hmm. And Batman sets this up with Batman, with the Joker, with Robin, with Catwoman, and all these characters. Yeah. And so you know they're going to, when you combine these ingredients, the chemical reaction is going to look like this. And it doesn't matter what other ingredients you add around that, that reaction is going to go down the same way. And I think that's what's enjoyable about the stories, because that reaction is good. Yeah. In Lupin, it's the same. You take Lupin, you take your side characters, which I guess we'll discuss in just a moment, you mix them together, you get the same kind of showdown and flavor of story, but you can add other stuff to change that and mix that up. Lupin can take place in space, Lupin can take place in Japan, it can take place in France, it can take place in a modern era, in gangsters 1920s, it doesn't matter. Like, Lupin will adapt and mold with the time. I just gave you a really good idea that hasn't actually been done. 1920s Lupin.
This would kind of break it, but like, I think we were talking about a feudal era Japan version of Pokemon.
Yep.
What if we had like a just ancient Japan version of Lupin?
It would work, because
where he would be like a ninja.
Yeah, yeah.
Fuck.
The characters would still obey the same rules,
yeah,
but just have to react to a different environment. Oof. And that's kind of why Lupin is so timeless. And we've been watching seriously from part 4 to part 5 only because the first three parts happened years before we were aware
either
of
us were born.
But in what we've seen consistently as we've progressed through it is every time we think Lupin's about to run out of ideas, or the show is going to run out of ideas or direction, they adapt. He's the most malleable character ever seen in any medium.
I agree. I totally agree. You can do any sort of genre or tone and it kind of fits any of that, because I think the characters are so consistent that they can work in any environment, because you don't actually need to think about where the characters are going or what they're doing in particular, because they so naturally work in whatever environment or setting that you put them in.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess, you know? I mean, let's just talk about how both of us came across Lupin.
Sure.
Yeah, you can go first.
Sure. So I found Lupin in the least likely place. I was at a friend's house, a group of friends were there kind of for food and movies, that kind of thing. And one of my friends pulls out this bootleg looking anime movie. And he's like the person least likely to watch anime. He does Star Wars and realistic war movies, that kind of thing. Not all this weeb crap. And he just pulls out this anime movie. And purely out of curiosity, I'm like, we've got to watch this. Like, why would my friend have this and why would he want to watch it? I've got to know what this anime is. And he was going to put it on and he says, oh, this is great. It's done by like the Ghibli Miyazaki people. And I'm like, oh, okay. You've got my attention now if Miyazaki's involved. And so we watched this movie and it opens. This is Castle of Cagliostro. Mm. So this is the entry point for most Lupin fans or people that have had any affiliation with Lupin. It's on Netflix currently if you want to check it out. Castle of Cagliostro is a Miyazaki produced before he was part of Ghibli Lupin movie, and it opens with the best car chase sequence in animation. It's still referenced to this day. In fact, there's a character in Cars, in the Pixar movie Cars, that is animated version of the car from this movie because it's so fundamental to animation students.
It is the reason why a cream-colored Fiat 500 is currently my dream car.
Yes. They drive this amazing little Italian car through this crazy road car chase. He finds a castle of secrets, and Lupin, to me, became an instantly likable, relatable character. We both have sideburns. Legit, that's part of the reason I love Lupin. He's just had this charisma about him that I found was very different to anime protagonists. Whereas other anime protagonists are very, you know, edgy or forget to have fun sometimes. Lupin knew how to have fun the whole time. He used cool gadgets and master thief kind of stuff. He was heroic. He did the right thing. He had interesting friends and companions. And it was just a wacky adventure. And I was hooked in. And I was like, whoa, what is this? I've got to go find more. So that was my first taste of Lupin. I'll get to my second taste once you tell me your first experience.
Yeah, so my first kind of exposure was actually through rap music.
Whoa, really?
So rappers have...
No.
So rappers have referenced Lupin.
You're kidding.
In several songs.
Who?
So Kanye West and Lupe Fiasco have both referenced Lupin.
Wow.
Yeah. So they've both referenced Lupin. And I remember hearing the name and knowing that it was an anime and looking it up. And it looked very cool. And it actually looked like something, oh yeah, like old school, like, you know, West Coast rappers would really love. And then I remember just thinking, oh yeah, I'll get around to it at some point. But accessing old anime back then when I was in high school and stuff was really difficult. And then I, you know, became a huge One Piece fan. I was a massive, massive One Piece fan. And a lot of the fan community, when talking about two characters in One Piece, the main character Luffy and Smoker, the comparison would often come up that they are like Lupin and Zenigata.
Right.
Which 100% they are. That dynamic is 100% based off the Lupin-Zenigata dynamic. To the point where in the really shit English dub of One Piece, the Four Kids one, they actually named the Zenigata character Chaser.
Really?
Because his original name was Smoker.
And you can't have that in anime.
Two cigars in his mouth, and they like kind of photoshopped it out and then just called him
like
Chaser.
To be like what? Like two
pan pipes? His mouth would just be open the whole time. It was really awkward. And so I remember thinking, oh, cool. So like one of my favorite characters is kind of based off, like the dynamic is sort of based off this thing. And I kind of became even more intrigued. And I then saw someone who's part of the One Piece community tweet about Lupin Part 4 and how it was on Crunchyroll and everything. So I started watching, and around the time I started watching, we were talking about anime, and I mentioned that. And then you mentioned that you were a massive fan.
Yep.
And that kind of motivated me to watch it.
Yeah.
And I was instantly hooked.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though Part 4 kind of expects you to know who these characters are, because they are so malleable, I kind of was
instantly... Yeah, you can go straight in and learn.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing was it was also based in Italy, which, you know, I'm a huge Italian weeb as well. So yeah, that was kind of my Lupin origin story.
So that's a much cleaner entry into Lupin for you. When I looked up, after I watched Casa Cagliostro, I looked up Lupin and I found it. There's a new season in 2013, 2014, whenever he did. I'm like, that's exciting. I thought this series would be long be dead. This movie looks so ancient from the 80s. Or it's actually from 79.
Yeah.
I think Castle of Cagliostro. So it's old, old film. I'm like, oh, as if they're still making it. That's fantastic. A brand new revival series. Put it in. it's the female character from Castle Cagliostro, who's very downplayed in that movie, naked on screen, jiggling around. I'm like, oh no, what am I watching? What is this hentai that I found? Turns out to be one of the greatest anime series I've watched, because it turns out to be much more intentional than I realized. But I was quite shocked that this is a very different tone of Lupin than I was expecting. And that's when I learned Lupin can be a wide variety of things.
Yeah.
And after that sexy season called A Woman Named Fujiko Mine, it then swings back into more classic kind of adventure hijinks, which is part four, and then it changes again in part five, which is a year of difference between those two seasons.
The comparison that I use is that Lupin part four felt like a Saturday morning cartoon, in a way, and then you go to A Woman Called Fujiko Mine and you're watching a HBO show.
It's like a Monday night SBS
thing. We've made ourselves Australian. Wait, our accents are Australian anyways. But yeah, it's, and that's, I remember you telling me about the miniseries as well, and I was thinking, oh, how different can it be? And it was a huge tonal shock. Oh, it's so
different, yeah. But
I was totally up for
the
it.
The characters are the same. They're a little bit different personally, but they're consistent. Lupin is
way more rapey in A Woman Called Fujiko Mine.
Not as, I mean, it's not as bad as the tone of season one of Lupin, which is extremely rapey. But no, but like, he's consistent in his behavior. He acts how you would expect Lupin to be act in the genre. All the characters are still the same, but this season, as we learn later, is like set up before they've met properly. So they're a bit young, green around the gills, but it's still fascinating how those characters jump and change tone and can explore different themes and elements.
Agreed.
Speaking of these characters, should we establish kind of who the core five characters of Lupin
are? Yeah, I think so. And we still haven't really figured out whether we want to do a character by character episode. We
can probably go in depth, but so when we refer to characters, people know who
definitely
they are.
Yeah. So I think we'll go, I mean, sorry, but I think we'll go from least important to most important.
Okay.
And this will kind of be a dowsing rod for where we think the characters are.
All right.
Do you want to go for least important from the core cast and say it at the same time? Three.
Goemon.
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, Goemon.
So
who is... Okay, so Lupin teams up with two other male characters.
That's right.
One female rival and one guy...
Male villain-ish.
Yeah. So in his team of friends... One of them is Goemon. Tell us about Goemon.
So Goemon is a bit of an anachronism. He is a Edo period samurai who is living in the modern age as a thief.
Yep.
He speaks with a very much Edo style accent. Mm-hmm. I think it's a Tohoku accent. I need to, oh my god, the weebs are going to crucify me for this. But he speaks
Japanese.
Yeah, yeah. And they all do. It's an anime, you nutto. But he speaks with a very much like an old style accent.
Very blunt, very formal.
If we were comparing it to like Anglo stuff, it would be like a medieval vowel sort of accent. Yeah. I went a bit British there.
Oh, it's a wee bit.
But so Goemon is very much an anachronism, and he is kind of like the superpowered being on the show.
Well, he's based on... I don't know much about this. I probably should have researched this first, but there's a famous Goemon character in Japanese literature and history.
Is there?
And that name gets used a lot. There's an anime character. It's like a blue-haired kid called Goemon.
Oh.
And that character's reinvented throughout the eras, and he's based on that.
That is so news to me.
He's taken from that, and that's where you've got your samurai-heavy influence.
Okay.
And he's introduced initially... We haven't seen this ourselves yet, but he's introduced initially as someone trying to attack Lupin. And he becomes a friend and a mainstay character in the series.
Okay.
So he was a villain and becomes the samurai in Lupin's world. And yet he's superhuman. What's he really good at doing?
He's good at cutting, my man.
Yeah.
What can he cut? A katana.
Can he cut a man?
Cut a man. He can cut a tree.
Can he cut a bullet?
He can cut a bullet.
He can cut a car. What else can he cut? Tell us more about these steak knives.
I mean, for you One Piece fans, he definitely gets to Roronoa Zoro levels of strength. Could he cut through
Luffy?
Well, yeah, he's rubber.
Yeah, true. There you go. You heard it here first. he's very good at cutting. That's his shtick.
His shtick, and he's also very conservative, very, like, you know, awkward around women.
Yeah.
And very much is like kind of like this chaste sort of samurai guy.
And he's a fish out of water because Lupin's adventures are very much globe hopping.
Mm.
So sometimes he's in Japan and he's fine there. But when they're in other countries, everyone's like, wow, look, a samurai. Or even in different eras as time goes on.
Yeah.
Why is a samurai still around?
He shouldn't be fine in Japan. Japan doesn't have people who just dress up like samurai with katana walking around.
But he personally is more at peace than... Yeah, he's definitely this last of an era, the last samurai kind of going around. And his function in the show is he's either an enemy of Lupin because he's defending something that's noble to him, or more often, he's one of Lupin's lackeys, and when Lupin needs a bit of muscle or someone to defend him, there's nothing the international police can do. He's going to cut through the bullets. He's going to cut through their police cars. Yeah. Nothing can kind of stop him.
Yeah, I think definitely, I don't know about the old series, but with the modern series, he often isn't there at the start of a lot of episodes.
No.
It's often Lupin. I was going to say Luffy there. Jeez, that's going to come out a lot. It's often Lupin and Jigen, who we'll get to a little bit later. But often the episode kind of, you know, builds and builds and builds. And then when they need like a third act sort of deus ex machina, Goemon comes in. He's the muscle, or he's like, you know, the savior there.
He's very kind of focused as a character. And so he gets boring if he's overused.
Mm.
And often they will, hold him back and use him later, or have him as comic relief. Often he gets his own episodes about his kind of slice of life adventures as a samurai, which is fascinating and a refreshing break when the show is getting quite samey with its tone.
Yeah, I totally agree. He's the once in a while sort of seasoning.
Yeah.
In the stew.
Yeah. Just to remind you that this is anime and not some European drama that you're watching. He'll rock up and cut things in half. And His the level of violence he displays varies depending on the intent of the Lupin show.
That's right.
He can cut people to the point where blood is spraying out of them. He can cut them, they just fall down and they're completely unhurt and just their clothes are
pulled. And they do the Japanese trope of, I only use the back of my
blade. Yeah, I just knocked you out. Or he later gets his own movie, which will end back in the future. And he slices pieces of meat off of people, like the ham.
Practicing surgeons use it as a reference point for human anatomy.
Really?
Because,
I don't know. That sounded like a legit fact. Wait, they use the car scene when they're making cars.
Jesus Christ. He cuts people up, basically.
Yeah. So that's his shtick. So who's Lupin's next best friend?
Do you want to go at the same time and see if we go? 1, 2, 3. Zenigata. Jigen.
Oh!
You think Jigen is less important than Zenigata?
Ooh, yes. Yes, I do.
No way!
I'm gonna stick to that. Yes.
No, but it's always Lupin and Jigen.
Yes, I think it's less important.
Alright, look, let's go, because we've already kind of talked about
We'll do the bros together.
We'll do the bros,
So Lupin's best friend is this guy called Jigen, a Daisuke Jigen.
Daisuke Jigen.
And he is the world's greatest sharpshooter.
Yeah.
He is basically wears a suit all the time, has a goatee. You rarely see his eyes, if ever. Yeah. I think I've maybe seen them one time I can maybe think of.
Yeah.
And he carries a revolver because that's the coolest looking gun you can have.
Yeah, shit. I know Lupin uses a Walther. What's the specific name of the gun that Jigen uses?
Oh, it has been mentioned. But
we're bad.
It's like a famous revolver brand.
Yeah, it's really famous,
And he's a very old world in that. He treats the revolver like it's a part of him.
Yeah, he's very much like the cowboy.
Yeah.
You know?
And his job is to back up Lupin in thieving missions often. Sometimes he's at odds with Lupin because he disagrees. He's kind of...
Rarely.
Yeah, but he's less personally involved in the game. Or the chase of being a thief. He is actually there
from
the start to be paid. I think it changes over time.
Interesting.
But...
I disagree. I think he's just as much in for the chase. Because we never really see him being that obsessed with the money and treasure.
He's less in love with it.
No, I think the part where it diverges is he doesn't care about the women and sexual aspect of thieving.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's the part where... And we can get into Jigen's sexuality later on in the podcast. But I think he is just as much excited by the thrill of it.
Mm.
I just think that the women aspect, which is, of course, a huge aspect in this, when dealing with luxury, is something that he doesn't care about. And once Lupin starts to think with his dick rather than, you know, everything else, that's when they start to diverge.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, he's I guess, speaking of sexuality, but not, he's the straight man to Lupin.
Yes.
So Lupin is wacky and zany and over the top. Mm. Jigen is very straight and narrow, like his shooting.
Yeah.
He'll rarely miss his target. He'll back Lupin up. He'll be loyal to Lupin's antics. He'll bail him out more often. Sometimes he's against him.
Yeah, but... and I don't know whether this is just because now the series is a bit old and the characters are kind of like settling in or like growing older, but he's very much like the crotchety old man in the group.
He'll complain. Like, he'll point at the flaws in the plan.
Yeah. There's several plots when he has dental issues. There's at least couple of, where he has like toothache. Toothache? Wow.
Teeth aches.
My job involves being good at language. Anyways, so where teeth are an issue, like he's very, and he's always complaining as well. So he's very much like the...
He's very apathetic. Mm. He's not emotionally invested in what they're doing.
But he's also very loyal.
Yeah. Incredibly loyal. Like of any character, he's actually the one Lupin can trust the most.
Definitely.
Except for maybe Zenigata.
In a way, I agree.
So who is Zenigata, Cleo?
Yeah, so Zenigata.
And why is he Lupin's dad?
No, I don't subscribe to that.
All right.
Zenigata is the other side of the coin to Lupin. So Lupin's the, you know, wacky, you know, like wacky, zany thief. Yep. Zenigata is the straight, narrow police officer.
Yep.
And his main job is to catch Lupin.
Yeah, he works at Interpol, so he's following Lupin country to country, trying to chase and track him down. He's his Tom to his Jerry.
He's frankly has an obsession with Lupin at this point. It's really interesting. I'm trying to think about whether Zenigata was in the original Arsène Lupin by Maurice LeBlanc. Because the thing is, in the anime, they've referenced the fact that Zenigata had an ancestor that tried to catch the original Arsène Lupin.
Oh.
But I don't think that's part of the original Maurice LeBlanc.
I don't think it's the same character, but I think there's an inspiration drawn from that.
Yeah.
And
it's very much the cat to Lupin's mouse.
Yeah. And Lupin needs that because most of his other villains are throwaway enemy of the week. Mm. And he's quite talented as a thief, so he doesn't have a lot of challenge, but Zenigata is a challenge because he's very much interrupting Lupin's missions and thieving abilities, and throwing quite a spanner in the works of that.
Though I feel like in recent seasons, Zenigata ends up being an ally more than often.
Yeah, they guess parrying Batman again, they develop this weird intimate connection because they've been at each other's throats so often. It's not as vicious as the Batman and Joker. Yeah. This is a genuine comedy more that is played for, that he's trying to catch Lupin, but Lupin outsmarts him every time. But he's come to respect Lupin deeply because no other enemy has ever challenged him as much. And he's dedicated, what, like 40, 60 years of his life
trying to hunt Lupin. Yeah. And like, even though Zenigata knows that Lupin is a criminal and that, you know, he's a thief, Zenigata kind of also knows that he's not a murderer or, you know, like a drug dealer or anything like that. So he knows that when situations get really bad and actual evil people are involved, he kind of gives Lupin the benefit of the doubt and they kind of, you know, team up on occasion.
Yeah, often. And what started as more comedy, because Zenigata hated it, they would be teamed up in a situation. Yeah. This even happens in Castle of Cagliostro.
Yeah.
And they're forced to work together. And those are some of the best moments on screen, because you have two characters that are so passionate for each other and in such an intense rivalry that when they come together and work for the common goal, it's just, oh,
yeah,
it's beautiful chemistry.
And that's the same thing in, I mean, for you One Piece fans, Luffy and Smoker is based on Lupin and Zenigata, because Luffy is the main character, he's the protagonist. He is kind of like a hero, but in the world of One Piece, he's a pirate, he's a criminal. And Smoker works for the Marines and he wants to capture Luffy, but he witnesses Luffy kind of do these acts that benefit the world. So even though he wants to capture Luffy, he knows that you know, he does have a heart, and they, you know, even Luffy on many occasions has told Smoker that, you know, he genuinely likes him, but they're just on opposite sides of the law. But if there wasn't that barrier, it's funny, they would probably be best friends, I think, because they, even though they're very different to one another, they pair together really well. And you know, we'll get into this when we talk about part 5, but there's this brilliant part in the part 5 end song where there's this idealized world where there's no constructs of thieves and law
in the
enforcers.
End credits,
In the end credits, and they're all friends and they're all chilling out at this
bar, a drink,
having a drink. So, you know, in a different world, they would be the best of friends, but because they're on opposite sides of the law, they are enemies. And that's one of the thing about Zenigata, is that he is the most noble sort of person, and he believes in justice more than any other character in this show.
Yes.
To the point where his sense of justice is never swayed. Yeah. It's like Batman.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you can push Batman however you'd like, but or Superman. It's like more accurate to Superman.
Yeah.
You can push Superman how much you like, but he'll never sway from his core ideals and morals.
And if Lupin is hurt or injured, Zenigata would risk his life to save Lupin. To save
him,
Or stop a greater evil threat, because Lupin is not evil, as you said,
Yeah.
And what's interesting, I think, as well, is unlike like Wile E. Coyote or Roadrunner kind of dynamic, there is genuine growth over the years.
Yeah.
And Zenigata starts it.
That's the dynamic that I was thinking about.
It's very
Roadrunner, Wile E.
Yeah, Roadrunner always comes up with something to outsmart him, so does Lupin. And he's very frustrated. It's the same slapstick of Zenigata will take physical pains trying to hunt down Lupin.
Exactly.
But unlike that, over the years, whereas Zenigata starts out very frustrated and failing Lupin, he does grow over time this deeper sense of friendship with Lupin. And there are key episodes throughout time where they face each other face to face, and they're like, what is the nature of a relationship? How's this going to end? How's it going to go down? It's those Batman Joker moments you always love.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's Zenny for now.
And now the main article. Our favorite character, right?
Yeah. I love Lupin and this character equally.
Yeah.
So we're at Fujiko Mine, who is the woman of anime.
Now, do you want to talk? Do you know what her name actually refers to?
You can mention this?
Yeah. So Fujiko, so now you'll notice Fuji, the name Fuji there.
For my favorite brand of apple.
Yeah, so it's actually a reference to the fact that Mount Fuji kind of looks like a boob, and Fujiko Mine actually translates to the mounded breasts of Fuji. So it's basically, her name is basically Big Tits.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which is also her most noticeable feature.
It is. It is, but I have to say, man, like, as much as I hate really badly, like, sexually proportioned anime women, there is something about Fujiko's character that I'm like, oh my god, she is so beautiful and, like, sensual.
Yes.
And,
She is this character that really rides the line that I've not seen in that archetype of character.
Yeah.
So her default archetype is she's a femme fatale, female, sexy thief.
Yeah.
She's your cat woman, she's your black cat, she's any other cat themed super villain.
Wow.
She's your Bond girl. She's like she is that. But Westerners tend to get caught up in that. They make them unnecessarily sexy and there's no payoff for that.
Yeah.
Fujiko is dripping in her sexuality.
Yeah.
As you see, especially in the miniseries that explores her character and why she's so over sexualized.
Mm.
But it always has a function and a purpose. Mm. She is someone that is completely devoted to the game of thievery.
And it's really hard to talk about Fujiko.
Well, because it's an anime, anime has not respected women, female characters, the way it should.
And the thing is, it's really hard because she is, in terms of her looks, very sexualized. And she does use it as a weapon, which I think a lot of people argue, and for a lot of situations, I would say the same thing, which is really misogynist to actually do something like that, to use that sex as a weapon. But why does it work for Fuji? I feel like, because I think you understand her a lot more than me.
I think she's very much explored in this Fujiko early thing. For her, the opening title sequence of A Woman Named Fujiko Mine explores her sexuality and her connection to thieving.
Yeah.
She is aroused by the art of thieving, and that's her biggest thrill in life. There is no greater chase, except maybe in recent times.
Yeah.
There's no greater chase.
You could almost argue that a young Fujiko would probably be asexual in a way, because she's only using it purely as a tool.
She's only in the... And so she will use whatever tactic, even if it's strip naked and punch a guy in the face, to get her prize, and that's satisfying. However, it's never satisfying enough. She needs more and more and more and more, and so she keeps getting thrown into the thrill. I think why it works that sexuality is her weapon is because she's strong in that. Like I think a lot of the problem with Batwoman or Batwoman, Catwoman.
Batwoman is great,
Black Cat. But I think a problem there is often that their sexuality is associated with a form of weakness.
Yeah.
Like, they crave into that and then they lose. They suffer when they start being over-sexualized. But for Fujiko, she achieves her mission and is successful by doing that. So the weapon is a powerful cannon. She can outsmart Lupin and with her sexuality. She can outsmart the bad guy with her sexuality. She often gets ahead of Lupin, and whole episodes finish with her getting the prize and her winning in a way, although often Lupin's done the right thing at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But she is capable. I would not want to face Fujiko in a fight. I'm not even sure I would want to know her
and
in real life
thing.
Because
yeah.
I would not be her equal in any capacity.
Yeah.
She is the super idealized woman in every capacity, although through a male lens, I do think so.
Yeah, and that's the kind of line that is really risky with Fujiko, is that is she only sexualized so that men can be aroused by it?
Mm.
And you know, the argument that I would have is that she understands what she is, and she has skills that are unrelated to her sexuality,
yeah,
which are also a huge defining part
because
of it.
Because she's not just sexy, she's one of the best martial artists in the universe.
Yeah.
She's one of the best mechanics in the universe.
Yes!
She's one of the best. She's able to fit in and blend in with any role. Scientist, teacher, historian, international spy, politician. She's a woman of many faces, able to adapt and adopt. Mm. And take on a role. And I think that's also one of her strengths, because I think, well, I personally believe a very good feminine quality is women that are able to take on multiple roles. Like, they're able to be mothers, they're able to be professional workers, like, they can do all these different things.
Well, or male or female.
Male or female,
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like I think like a bad female character is when they're bound to just one role. And
yeah,
they
well,
never...
Mm, and, yeah. And that's because, you know, historically we don't have as many stories that are about women.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time when people want to write a story about a woman, rather than making them just a human character, they use a used stereotype and it becomes that one note sort of character.
And if she's scared or captured, it's because she's placed herself in that situation and is trolling the captives.
Yeah.
She's not scared.
She uses the trope to her advantage.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? She uses the trope
yes.
as a weapon. And that's what I think kind of defines the line between it being hyper problematic versus this is really clever.
Yeah, and I think because there are many anime women that will be hostages or captive and then they've lost their ability.
Yeah.
As soon as they're restrained, they can't do anything to fight back and that sucks.
That said, we do have to kind of disclose we are both straight male talking really in depth about female characters. So I think definitely one of the goals for me in the podcast is because one of the biggest parts of Lupin's fiction is about Fujiko, that one of the most defining series is about Fujiko. She's actually the main character. I definitely think we need to get some women on board into the podcast to talk about it and get their opinion on it as well. We do know that series was written and directed by a woman.
Yeah, a female was involved in a lot of the writing and the direction that took. And I think that is a much deeper understanding in that from a female perspective than we can quite. Yeah,
I think we're still kind of just saying, you know, what our opinion is, but definitely we would like to get some outside opinions. And
the Fujiko Mine series explores very, maybe not logically, but very practically why she is how she is, and she grows from that point.
Definitely.
And I really only made sense of this through a second screening. Like, there's a lot to unpack there. But she was much more broken at the start of that season, and she later learns to cover up and only make use of her sexuality in certain circumstances.
Well,
rather than... Well, she goes from being a machine gun to being like...
But that was plot related, though. She always knew who she was.
She...
Well, let's talk about this for the podcast that
we'll
do.
We'll save that for
talking
specifically
about that
the
series. Because I think... Guys, look, that is both of our favorite Lupin story. Like, it's both of our favorite sort of series from Lupin, and I think we run the risk of every podcast
becoming about a
woman called Fujiko
Mine.
Yeah,
yeah. I guess, hang on, with that character, she's very fundamental because she's a love interest and a rival to Lupin. That's her role in the team.
Love interest, rival, and kind of the reason why he gets up in the morning.
Yeah.
Right?
So in the early days of the season, and again, Fujiko changes based on the era and the part we're in.
She, I would say, definitely, like you said, in terms of she takes on different roles, everyone else is kind of the same in terms of their aesthetic. Fujiko changes.
She changes hair, she changes design, she changes how sexualized she is.
Yeah.
There's part three of Lupin is known as the comedy series, where Lupin lost a bit of momentum and flow, and it became your
Pink
standard,
Jacket,
Pink Jacket series. became the more comedy thing. And so Fujikura's sexuality becomes downplayed as comedy. The classic anime, oh, look, it's an attractive female, and the protagonist wants her, but he can never have her, and she slaps him. That kind of humor. She comes a bit dumbed down as that. But throughout the eras, she will then take on, like, she is the hero in this. She's the heroine. She is a badass. Let's explore her. She's very adapts very much throughout the era.
Yeah, and she's kind of the backbone in a lot of the modern stories. Yeah. She's kind of like, initially you think she is like an antagonist, but she's actually looking out for Lupin and the crew. We can talk more about her dynamic with the crew later on, but she's actually looking out for them, and she's kind of like the structural backbone. Whilst they're kind of, you know, getting a bit misguided with things, she's the one who kind of holds it all together, even though a lot of the time she's doing it for her own benefit, and she'll end up kind of, you know, pulling the wool over their eyes. She is the backbone of the crew.
So sometimes she helps Lupin, sometimes they're together, sometimes they're not, sometimes she rescues them, sometimes she sabotages them. Sometimes she's working for the bad guy. Sometimes she's the bad guy's love interest. Yeah. Sometimes she's manipulating everything behind the scenes. Like, she pops in and out. Sometimes she eats meals with them. But yeah, you never quite know where she's going to be. You just know she's going to betray someone at some point.
Yeah, and she's the wild card. Not necessarily betray, because I think then you get into that trope of, oh, the woman is always like against the man, and I think that's a little bit more problematic. No. I would say she's always the one where you don't really know where she's gonna go.
Yeah.
But at the core, there is
you're never sure what her allegiance is except to the prize.
Yeah.
To the treasure, exactly. To the goal. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. She's very much the Joker in the series, in the sense that she's the element of chaos and anarchy. For sure.
Yeah, because like she can be the turning point of an episode. If Lupin's going head-to-head with a villain, she can come in with a rocket launcher and completely change how that fight's going to go down.
Exactly, exactly. So, let's talk about the structure of the series so far. So,
As far as we understand it,
a lot of the series does one-off stories.
Yep.
Definitely, that's how it was done in the old days, was that, you know, it was very much a Saturday morning cartoon. Yep. Every episode was one and done, and then kind of would reset it to the baseline every week.
Yep.
Though what we've seen in the last couple of series is that, you know, they are doing these longer storylines, which allows the characters to kind of morph a little bit more and do things that are a little bit more interesting, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. I guess, do we talk about the jackets and how that lays out? So Lupin, it has a very interesting anime structure, which I think is a very good structure, and I kind of wish more anime took this approach. So it's technically been running in one consecutive series since, like, the 80s? Is that? Oh, 70s.
When did 70s. It started in 71.
71.
October 24th, 71 was the one, part one, the anime.
And that's
started
about 20-ish, 22-ish episodes, I think, part one. Mm. And that's known as the Green Jacket series, because Lupin wears a green blazer jacket in this series. That's the fundamental, very early animations, a lot of still frames, but high-octane action for the era. Very jazzy, very 60s inspired, like, think Thunderbirds, James Bond, Get Smart kind of era, but more
very
action-y.
James Bond.
Yeah, very pulpy adventures, very global as well. Then you get the second part, it's called part two, the second series, which he's wearing a red jacket in that. He's designed, it's a bit more fluid, he's designed a bit more differently proportional, more comedic, and that's like 100 or something episodes, isn't it?
That's the longest one, and it was the most popular series. Yeah. Although I think Blue Jacket era is getting
about
there
to take over. Yeah,
about to take over. But Red Jacket was what popularized.
Yeah, most people
the show
would have seen a red jacket. Castle Cagliostro is a red jacket.
No, he wore a green jacket.
Green jacket, that one. Okay, Castle Cagliostro. Red Jacket. Is the most popular because it ran for so many years, and that's if you've seen it from vintage times. That's when you would have seen Lupin. The series after that is Pink Jacket, which is where I think Lupin lost a lot of popularity.
Yeah,
part three.
I think we still have to do our research.
Yeah, we'll have to break into it
the
more.
The origins of it, but I believe that Pink Jacket broke the series.
It became very Saturday morning slapstick.
It's followed. It actually followed a very much a classic Doctor Who story. Doctor Who started in the '60s, very pulpy, very cool. Became hugely popular
it's
in the '60s and
seventies.
And then towards the end of the '80s, the wackiness just broke the show.
Yeah.
And then it had a revival in the early 2000s. And now it's bigger than ever.
I mean, there's even parallels Batman again with the '60s Silver Age stuff. Becoming quite silly. And to the point where in the latest season, they do a throwback episodes at different points, different eras of different jackets.
Which I can't wait till we get to Green Jacket. Green
Jacket will be pretty interesting. But they do a Pink Jacket throwback, and the plot is literally Lupin has to open a safe by lowering his brain cells to zero. And so Fujiko hits him with hammers until he's dumb enough to open the safe.
And the animation and becomes way more choppy,
bright colored. It nearly looks like Yo-Gai Watch or like a Pokemon nearly. Very bright palette, very kid and very corny with characters that you just don't care about. And that was, very interesting that's how the current makers of Lupin view that series. It's nearly like a game show or commercial, like very silly. And so that was Pink Jacket series. Then there's a break for quite a few years.
The wilderness years.
When would Pink Jacket have finished? Like
the 80s or 90s, maybe?
And then it's silent until about 2012. Oh, no, it's not silent. Okay. Lupin is a cultural icon. And so they made a whole bunch of Lupin movies in between. So Lupin became a thing you'd do a movie for. He's in a lot of interesting standalone events in the movies. Yeah. And even a live action movie. He crosses over with Detective... we need to watch that one. That'll be a whole podcast, I think.
Yeah.
He crosses over with Detective Conan... a few times. Conan's a big icon in Japan.
Which is great because Detective Conan is a character based on Sherlock Holmes, and then Lupin the Third is a character based on Arsène Lupin.
So I guess that's kind of like what it is, the Japanese version of these characters. A lot of interesting standalone movies. But then his next series came in the form of a woman named Fujiko Mine, which shifted the focus from Lupin himself to Fujiko, who was a fan favorite from the series for years. But this is where they started to revisit Fujiko. What makes her relevant?
She's actualized as a character, I think.
And the series is set up, although very cryptically, as an origin point for a lot of these characters.
Yeah, it takes place before any of the other series.
And you can tell because Lupin's wearing a green jacket, the first series. And so it's how they connect and come together and how Fujiko forms as a woman. And this show has an incredibly darker tone. It deals with real-world politics, such as, the Russian missile crisis. Yeah. It's very much set in the 60s aesthetic. Everything's heavily shaded. It's very unique anime style. Much darker. Lupin is differently proportioned. He has less comedic eyes. Zenigata is gruffer and less of a comedy element.
Very bold. Big and...
Lupin is also gruffer and pervy and slimier as a thief.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how these characters, that's canon, that they're rougher and grosser and mature but less mature in value. They start off with
a darker crime origin and then become more swashbuckling. About swashbuckling, that's when we get to part four.
Yeah, so part four, do you want to explain part four? Because you love this one a lot.
Yeah, so part four and also part five is kind of known as the Blue Jacket era. And it's
which is the most beautiful outfit. The Blue Jacket is my favorite.
I like the red look more, but each to their own. The Blue Jacket era is the modern reboot of Lupin. Though it doesn't entirely feel that modern because it's very swashbuckling, very action heavy.
Still referencing the old world European influence.
They seem to be taking a lot of European influence. So part four was based all in Italy.
And it even launched with Italian dubs in Italy.
That's right. Yeah. And now part five is meant to be French-inspired, though. It's becoming more globe-trotting than we previously thought.
Well, part four is a return to form. Here are the characters. Let's embed and tell really strong Lupin stories.
And it throws you in there. It expects you to know who these characters are, but these characters are so firm in what they are that me not knowing anything about the show was able to watch the first couple of episodes of part four and go, I can run with this. I know who these people are, right?
And there is long-running arcs in that season.
Yes, but this is where we get to the long-form storytelling.
There's lots of short stories. Episodes, one-offs, and that explore specifically what are these characters in their relationship, what is these dynamic in this character.
And then part five is very much, who is Lupin?
Yeah.
Why is Lupin? Now it's where is Lupin going?
Yeah.
Part five is probably the most existential
part
of the show. And it's because in 2017, Lupin the Third had its 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
So part five was meant to be French inspired because they want to go back to the origins of his connection to the original Arsène Lupin.
Yeah.
We still haven't gotten there yet in the series. I think it'll be the kind of climax of this season, but it'll be interesting to kind of find out some stuff around that. We'll probably save that for our part five podcast I think that's the one that kind of inspired us doing this podcast is because it got so existential and self-analyzing. Well, it's airing right now,
so we always have something to talk about, and we were trying to predict what is the path of this series, and it's both being predictable and unpredictable.
Yeah, it's kind of going out of that whole, we're resetting from every season, like every season of past Lupin series resets it back to normal, but this one is actually changing and morphing the characters more so than we thought, and it's having much bigger, longer plot lines as well.
We didn't actually realize Lupin was all part of the same continuity until this happened, and we sat down and we're like, hang on, there's growth from 4 to 5. Is there growth from 1, 2, 3? Yes. Is there growth in Fujiko? Yes. Hang on, Lupin's been this whole long-running series.
It all matters. Yeah. It's like, I don't know, have you ever seen that interview that Kevin Smith does with Grant Morrison?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that.
It's that Batman thing.
He writes Batman as if everything happened.
Everything happened, and this Lupin is definitely as if everything has happened.
And everything doesn't have to have happened exactly the same way, but there's been growth across it as a meta arc for these characters.
Yo, what if we got Crisis on Infinite Lupins and we had all the different colored jackets and they're all trying to like battle each other, and you have like this really like gruff rapey green jacket Lupin and this really wacky pink jacket Lupin, swashbuckling blue jacket.
There is a movie that's red jacket versus green jacket, and an imposter Lupin puts on one of the other jackets.
We
should watch
that. Can we watch that together?
He fights another version of himself.
We even came up with the idea today, like what if there was a rival gang and you had like a European medieval knight for Goemon, male version of Fujiko. we could talk about we could talk about this for hours, but I think we'll probably start to wrap it up. What we're going to try and do is maybe talk about some of the modern episodes and maybe go back in time as well and talk about some of the old stuff. Once we get this episode out there, we'd definitely like to hear about what you guys would want from a Lupin podcast. We did a little bit of looking ourselves and we couldn't really find too much in that avenue, so hopefully we're kind of creating something.
We want to raise the profile. There's good anime and there's not good anime. And even when there is good anime, I wouldn't often tell people to watch it. I only tell people in a niche. Honestly, I'd say to anyone to watch Lupin. It's something in there for everyone. And it's unlike any other anime. If you're sick of Japanese tropes being overdone, Lupin tends to reinvent the genre.
It's honestly something that I'm really surprised that Hollywood hasn't gotten. It's really
Easy money for Westerners, but they don't know
I think there's definitely a reason why, but we haven't figured it out yet. Like there's some sort of reason hiding in plain sight, because it is, it almost seems too good to be true. Yeah. You know?
Like each character is so simple in who they are and how they function, then they can transform into any genre. And yet, I guess it's possible to get that wrong if you don't know how to treat these characters.
That's right.
But I guess that's why I love it. There's so much to it. Every time I think it's going to get old, it does something incredible.
Today, I fall deeper in love. We were watching the last couple of episodes today, and we were talking about some stuff that might have potentially broken the show.
Yeah.
And it did it, and it did it in such a wonderful, satisfying way. I was running around the house.
Yeah, Cleon jumped up out of his chair. I was like, oh my gosh, I was right.
I was so hyped, because episode 2, I kind of created my own fan fiction for Lupin and Fujiko, and they did it almost beat by beat, what I thought would be right. Like, I even remember saying, like, maybe they decided to get married or get together after this really intense sort of, like, heist or adventure together. And it's exactly what they did.
Yeah, we got teased, so,
So, we're really keen to talk about it. Let us know what you think. And, we will probably be Arsène Lupin on several social media avenues, though I don't know if it's been taken or not. We'll probably have to talk about where you can find us on our next episode.
Asinine Lupin will be there.
We're Asinine Lupin. That's right. Not Asinine.
Asinine. How do you say it? I don't know.
Asinine. You came up with the name. That's true. Asinine Lupin. We'll follow it all up. And thanks
for letting us steal your time.